This is episode 34 of The Fifth Estate. Tom Nichols, Trump's first 10 days, the executive orders, and the Supreme Court.
Did you know your monthly cell phone bill could be funding extreme liberal causes? That's right. Every time you make a call or send a text, you could be supporting left-wing organizations that want to grow the size of government and expand the nanny state. Fortunately, Patriot Mobile is helping you take a stand. Patriot Mobile is the nation's only conservative cell phone company. Patriot Mobile offers exceptional coverage and service and comparable or even lower prices than other cell phone carriers. And the best part is up to 5% of your monthly bill goes to the conservative organization of your choice. There's no catch, just outstanding coverage, service, and the latest, greatest devices. So put your money where your values are and expand the civil discourse by switching to Patriot Mobile today. Patriot Mobile will even buy out your current contract up to $350, or they'll offer a free iPhone 6 with a $60 talk, text, or data plan, or a free Galaxy S7 with a $70 talk, text, or data plan. Call 1-800-A-PATRIOT today or visit patriotmobile.com/ricochet. That's 1-800-A-PATRIOT or patriotmobile.com/ricochet.
All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso, along with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm a bit of a grump, but nobody wants to hear about that.
Well, we know that you're always a grump, but you know, as much as a grump as Neil is, one of the things we ask our dear listeners is, you know, always we appreciate it. If you go out to iTunes, leave us a review, subscribe if you can, tell your friends to subscribe, all that good stuff.
Yes, please do. We depend upon your feedback to make this show better.
Yes.
To make it grow, to help us to continue to draw in fantastic guests and provide you with an hour's entertainment to while away the days.
So, Neil, we have some
breaking news.
All right. So, as you know, we're recording this on the day that Donald Trump has chosen a Supreme Court justice nominee to replace Antonin Scalia. And we're also going to talk about Donald Trump's first, you know, 10 days in office and some of the things that have gone on, the media coverage of it. And we have decided to bring aboard Tom Nichols to join us. Tom is a, you know, he's the senior contributor at The Federalist. You know him on Twitter as Radio Free Tom. He also works for the, you're still a professor at the Naval College, right?
I hope so.
Okay. Every time I look online, you're always about to get fired by somebody's trying to tell you
he
that.
He still is, as long as we remember that the opinions expressed here tonight are his own and do not represent those of the Naval War College or any other employees.
Exactly.
Because Tom's always getting threatened. He's always like, when you get fired, this is going to be funny. And Tom's always laughing at people that threaten him with firing who have no role in his employment, but it's kind of funny anyway.
We had we had Tom on, I think, back in October before the election, and had a great time talking about things, and ready to hear from one of the bright lights of the Twitter sphere here.
Yes.
On Trump's first 10 days.
All right, so let's talk about first the choice of Donald Trump's choice for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch from the he's a 10th Circuit judge. Tom, first impressions. What do you think?
Well, what's surprising about it is that it was exactly the pick conservatives hoped for and didn't think they would get, and they got it. And, you know, I've been a critic of the president, certainly during the campaign, but, you know, when you get it right, you get it right. And I think this was probably the one of the best picks he could have made. I'm not a legal expert. I'm not a jurist, but, you know, insofar as I follow the conservative and liberal trends on the court, this is clearly a conservative pick, but obviously a stellar jurist. And one of the most interesting things is that President Obama's solicitor general, who ironically enough, I'm actually old enough to say was one of my students back at Dartmouth 25 years ago, just came out and said what a great nominee he was and what a stellar lawyer he is. So that's, know, when you get that kind of bipartisan support from people who are telling you that this is an able future justice, I think, you know, you've made the right pick and you're probably not going to have that much trouble in the Senate. Although just by saying that, I'll be proven wrong. In so,
Let me go back, get in the way back machine here. Now, when Justice Souter was nominated, he was expected to be a fairly reliable conservative vote, wasn't he? And that didn't work out so much. Do we think Gorsuch is going to have any kind of similar Souterisms?
I'm going to take issue with you. I mean, I remember when Souter was nominated, and at the time, there were all kinds of questions about, you know, that there wasn't a whole lot of a paper trail. And President Bush, the first President Bush, 41, was criticized pretty hard at the time for putting in what a lot of even conservatives at the time said was a stealth nominee. That Bush had purposely picked somebody who didn't have a long paper trail on things like abortion or religion and issues like that. So I don't think anybody can make that case about Gorsuch. I think there were some of those concerns about Hardiman, that he could turn out to be a suitor, but I think it's going to be really hard to make that argument about Gorsuch. With that said, remember that every Supreme Court justice can surprise you. I mean, you know, was it Nixon who said about Warren, you know, or Eisenhower said about Warren, worst decision I ever made? You know, Roberts has broken some hearts, and there you don't often get a Scalia where the record is one that conservatives just point to as having never been a disappointment. So there's always the possibility, but I don't see that. I mean, at this point, I don't see that you can make that case in the way you could about Souter.
Yeah, and there is a SCOTUS blog for anybody who wants to read anything about the Supreme Court. They should be reading SCOTUS blog. Had a you know, kind of like a background on Gorsuch and going over, you know, his not only his credentials but also, you know, where he agreed with Scalia. And there was one area where they said they disagreed, but it's not even something that should concern conservatives. It was about administrative law, but almost on every other area. They said that they're kind of in agreement, and you know, from what I've been reading too, people are saying it's like his opinions are terrific. You know, very plain spoken, a layman can read them and kind of understand what he's talking about. And so, you know, and I had a discussion with Ben Domenech, and it was funny because I said you know, it's possible that Trump could sit there and do one of those things where he changes his mind and picks somebody that he said he would, or he'd break his promise or something. But this seems to be keeping in line with something that he's done, at least here for the first couple of weeks, is done this thing where he's doing what he said he was going to do. He promised everyone he was going to get, it was going to be a nomination that would be in the mold of Scalia. And like you said, it looks like he's done that.
He's just buttering us up for when he nominates his sister.
that's what Ben said. He goes, the second choice is going to be the one that conservatives are going to go crazy about, because where he could change the direction of the court, he will kind of go, he'll go wobbly.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I think, and, you know, as always, as we said at the top of the show, I'm just representing my personal opinion here. I don't speak for anybody else. I don't think Supreme Court nominations really matter that much to Donald Trump. I think, you know, keeping with my overall theory that the president is now the president because he ran a campaign that he didn't really expect to win, I think things like Supreme Court justices, but in the world of the Trump campaign at the time, are kind of just terminally boring. It's an easy thing to give conservatives, right? I mean, the Supreme Court nominations only become really difficult when the president or people around the president really have a kind of deep theoretical interest in a particular judicial philosophy. Whereas if you're just saying, look, give me the guy that's going to, you know, get the most applause from the most conservatives, and then we can kind of get by this and I can get a win out of it. Because remember, for better or for worse, the president's a very transactional kind of guy. And there's no upside in bucking the conservatives by nominating somebody different than somebody like Gorsuch. There's no plus side to it. So, I mean, in a way, it totally makes sense. Now, that second nomination, I don't know. I mean, if there is a second nomination, I still don't see, unless he just wants to, you know, make his sister happy, or that he feels like he, you know, owes a nomination to somebody, you know, or somebody in his circle thinks they owe a nomination to somebody. But otherwise, this is not the hill to die on for a Trump administration. This is easy stuff to give away. I think I'm still expecting, and this goes back to the argument I had with Hugh Hewitt months ago, you know, you're going to get the Supreme Court nominee you want, but is everything else you're going to have to sell in the conservative movement, like foreign policy,
right,
like executive overreach, all that other stuff, is it going to be worth it? And I'm not convinced.
It's sort of like, you know, maybe how the Democrats gave up their majority in Congress to enact Obamacare, which they knew they were going to take massive hits on, but they still went ahead and did it, I guess. I don't know. Maybe that's somewhat comparable.
Obama personally, I mean, I think Democrats gave up, you know, those 1,000 seats, including the Congress and everywhere else. I always say that they basically burned them on the altar of President Obama's cult of personality.
Mm-hmm.
That to defend the president, that to defend then President Obama and Obamacare, they were willing to just destroy their seed corn for a generation. I hope that doesn't happen with this, where 4 or 8 years, but certainly 4 years from now, we all look back and say, well, we got that one justice out of everything, but it's a shame that all of Europe is now a Russian-speaking plantation.
Yeah, that is kind of a worry, and that actually reminds us of a conversation that we had with John Schindler a little bit ago, in which he brought up the specter of Chinese, Russian, Soviet, or nuclear war. That would have been fun. So the thing that I'm kind of interested in, you know, obviously this is a nomination that conservatives will applaud. And they should be, you know, happy that you know, Trump is in a position to nominate these people so that they can get some wins, I suppose. But I am interested in that idea of, you know, what are they going to have to put up with? You know, obviously we've got President Trump's kind of, let's say, difficult personality, challenging personality. And we have the increased social tensions that we're seeing now with Democrats and progressives marching in the streets. So how much are conservatives and Republicans in general going to have to put up with, and how much damage to the brand can they sustain before it's just not worth it?
Well, let me back up for a minute and say something in defense of Democrats here. If I were, you know, a Democrat, and I'm not, but were I, I'd be pretty pissed tonight. I mean, you know, I said back when Justice Scalia died, you don't have to approve a new justice, but the president is the president until the end of his term, and he gets to put somebody forward. And I think Garland at least deserved a hearing. I don't think that the Senate had to confirm him, or you know, it's the advice and consent of the Senate, right? I mean, they don't have to do anything. But the Republicans pretty effectively stonewalled that nomination and in effect set a precedent that said, you're only the president for 7.5 years.
Yeah.
Some matters, which I think Republicans, that could come around and bite them in the ass at some point down the line. And I think that's an unwise precedent to set. So there on some of these matters, I think Democrats are well within their rights to be completely pissed off. With that said, I'm doing a piece now that probably by the time the show's on will run in the Washington Post, where I said, you know, people have to stop overreacting. They have to stop going total code red, DEFCON 1, 5-alarm fire on every single thing Trump does. He won the election. Presidents get to appoint people. They get to have the people they want around them. They get to staff the National Security Council, as distasteful as it may be to foreign policy professionals. They get to staff the NSC and the other organizations with the people they want. And the Democrats can't keep, and the liberals and other opponents of the president can't just keep piling into the street every day over things that are pretty much the normal exercise of presidential power. And I think if they keep doing that, they're setting themselves up for a loss in 2020. I think that the American people are going to just tune them out. They're going to get just numb and worn down. by the constant, you know, this kind of outrage fatigue. And I don't think that's a good idea. So I think Democrats, liberals, people that, you know, the election didn't go their way, they, I think they have a lot of things to be reasonably upset about. As you guys know, a lot of things that I'm really concerned about. But going into the trenches every day over everything is not a good strategy for surviving the long term, for going long term in a political competition.
Yeah. So let's, I mean, if it's funny, if you think about it, Donald Trump has been president for what, 11 days? And it feels like it's been 11 months already with the, I mean, every single day is yet another freak out by the Democrats over something that Donald Trump does. But let's kind of step back and talk a little bit about his first 11 days and some of the things that he's done that he said he was going to do, which, you know, like the Keystone Pipeline and you know, that was something that conservatives applauded. Even he even got thanks from the labor unions on those moves. So some of the stuff has been good, but we'll talk about the executive order separately. I want to keep that separate. But let's talk about, you know, prior to that, everything that he had kind of done. I mean, basically, there was no legislation passed by Congress. It was all executive orders. I have to admit, you know, and this is kind of funny. I don't understand what the big deal was with him signing an executive order and then kind of holding it up for the press. I think it was Bill Maher that said he kind of looked like a kid holding up his homework for mommy and saying, look, I'm done. So let's talk about those. Before we get to the executive order, let's talk about everything up to that. What's your kind of impression of how it went?
Well, I don't think it was a good 11 days because it's been characterized by so much backing and forthing. And I think one thing that's very clear out of this White House is they're not strong on message discipline. When the president says something or signs an executive order and the next morning, you talk to three presidential surrogates and they all say different things. Of course, you know, Sean Spicer's first press conference will now go down in presidential history. That's one for the museum after that really kind of weird Saturday moment about inauguration crowds and all that stuff. I think it's an administration that keeps stepping on its own story, because if you just look at the stuff that was signed, there is a lot of good stuff in there about, like, as you say, the Keystone Pipeline, and keeping campaign promises. They may not be things that, all of them are not things that I may like, but he actually sat down and said, here's the things I said I would do. And one of the reasons that story could have looked better than it did is because there was a natural Republican presidential agenda waiting there for whoever stepped in behind Barack Obama.
Exactly.
I think one of the things that we have to keep clear here is that there was a real opportunity for the next Republican president to look really good, because Obama had just dug in his heels on so many things that the next guy had to do was to pull the cork out of things like the Keystone Pipeline and things like Affordable Care Act. Now, you know, again, I'm not sure that it's a smart idea to simply unravel the Affordable Care Act, but signing an executive order really quickly saying, I am, you know, Mitt Romney said that, right? Mitt Romney said, day one, I'm going to roll back the ACA. And so all of those things were easy enough to do because Obama teed them all up through sheer obstinacy. Just as, and in fairness, the sheer obstinacy of the Republican Senate, I mean, this was all gridlocked at the last minute. What amazes me is the new administration managed to step all over those stories by just complete lack of message discipline. And
absolutely,
by the president is, you know, addicted to Twitter. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I think
if
you go back to the very beginning, which is a very good place to start, Inauguration Day. This should have been, as John Podoretz said, this should have been the best day of his presidency, right? Should have been a day for celebration. Should have
and
been
it was the worst.
And it was absolutely all like. He gets on Twitter, so the story goes, and he sees people saying bad things. He sees the protests happening in Washington, or the anarchist riots, or whatever you want to call it. Not really anarchists, I suppose. But so he sees this, and he just fixates on it, and he broods on it, and he lets his resentment get the better of him. And that colors the entire first weekend.
Yeah.
Like, the bloom was off the rose immediately. And I have to say that, you know, with another Republican, as Tom said, with another Republican, all these, you know, executive orders and these layups, they would have been done. But you wouldn't have had this person coming out and just getting in his own way at every turn.
But, you know, interestingly, when you talk about that first day, I mean, this is the what if it were me, right? I mean, any one of us. First day of a new presidency, you get out there, you give the most important speech of your life up until that moment. The only thing more important might be when he has to give a speech about war and peace. But you would think, you know, you're now the president. The guy with the nuclear football is never more than a few feet away from you. You're back at the White House. You're in the Oval Office. It certainly wouldn't occur to me to sit down and start getting on Twitter about how the lying New York Times didn't say there were enough people there. I mean, the whole thing came across as weird, and it suggested to me, now I'm a former staff guy, both in state and federal government, and it just struck me, isn't there somebody saying, Mr. President, it's the first day, let's not do this. Boss, this is not a good idea.
And instead, well, no, because
you guys point out, it just set the tone for the whole week in such a sour way. And the press, by the way, I'll just add one more thing, and then I'll shut up. The press saw this because I mean, in one sense, the Trump administration is right. The press is the opposition party. I mean, Bannon, you know, he's not wrong about everything. The press probably hates this president more than any since Nixon, and maybe even more than that. And it's mutual. They hate each other. But when he went that road on Inauguration Day, he opened the door to a lot of reporters saying, well, OK, if that's what the president wants to talk about, here's some pictures of empty stands along Pennsylvania Avenue. Now let's see what he says. And here's some pictures from the National Park Service. Now let's see what he says. And instead of, you know, as you guys were saying, picking that low-hanging fruit that Obama left there for any Republican president, he walked right into a bear trap of his own making, and the media was more than happy to accommodate him for the next 72 hours. And I think it totally blew his first week, certainly in terms of public image. It blew his first week, blew a lot of opportunities that he had hanging there in his first week.
Agreed.
Absolutely agreed. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Neil Dewing is going to tell you about our good friends over at Blue Apron.
Friends, are you tired of uninspired takeout options or recipes that have you running hither and yon looking for exotic ingredients that you'll use once or maybe twice and then throw away? Well, let me tell you about Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They do this by supporting a more sustainable food system and setting the highest standards for ingredients, building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron is pretty affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, they'll deliver seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. That means they send you the right amount of ingredients to make the right amount of meals right to your door. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. The recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Some of the upcoming meals include cashew chicken stir-fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. I don't know what tango mandarins are, but they sound interesting. You could also try roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad. Fun. Crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. Or udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card. And again, pre-portioned ingredients. You can prepare them in 40 minutes or less. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or Blue Apron will make it right. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/fifth.
All right, and we're back. So we're gonna talk about the executive order, kind of close out with that, a discussion about that. But let's also talk about, I wanted to talk about the media coverage of Donald Trump. I mean, we just went over the whole issue of Trump, you know, obsessing over ridiculous things about crowd sizes and things of that nature. And, you know, it's true. It is ridiculous. But then what I also happened to notice was, you know, you went through like the media, you know, you go on the internet, you turn on TV, that's all the media was talking about was how they kept saying that these numbers weren't true. And that, you know, they're talking about his landslide electoral college victory. And it was driving me crazy because, you know, there was the shooting that took place in San Antonio Mall. And the night that happened, when you went to CNN.com, it wasn't even on the front page. But there was probably about six or seven stories about, you know, about them talking about crowd size at the inauguration.
But here's the thing. If you're the media and you already don't like the president and you're, you know, you're still pretty bitter about the way that election went, I think you could make the argument of saying, hey, if this is the stuff the president wants to talk about, God forbid that we hijack the agenda. We'll let the president talk about what he wants to talk about and never interrupt him while he's hurting himself. And I think that, you know, they, in that sense, it's a win-win for the media because they can say, hey, we're just going where the news is. He's the president now. And I think this is where the White House I don't think they've internalized this notion that every time the president sneezes, it's a presidential sneeze. It's news. It's going to be covered. And I think, you know, the president himself, I think, is still getting used to the fact that actually Obama had the same problem, by the way. Obama used to think out loud. This drove me crazy about Barack Obama. He'd get me on a podium. He'd say, well, I suppose if I'm thinking about it, and you'd say, please, Mr. President, stop. We don't need to know every thought. It's okay to have a thought you don't express. And I think, you know, President Trump has the same problem. And I think that leads them, that leads the media to say, if you'd like to go on there and talk about, you know, crowd size and inauguration, we will be more than happy to be your enabler for that self-destructive behavior.
I would also say that I think that the media is part of, you talked about going to DEFCON 1. You know, there are people in the media that react that way, and you know, it's counterproductive on their part because of the fact that, you know, Trump has this kind of relationship with the media, and the true believers, I call them, the ones who are, you know, that have been, you know, supporting him from the start, basically they love that stuff, so they're seeing it and they're loving it. You know, now whether or not that actually translates over to, you know, kind of middle of the road voters over the next couple of years is something. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, you know, I think at certain points, you know, the media has they can take them up on that opportunity and say, we're going to cover this. But when they're going to sit there, like I was watching Morning Joe a week or two ago when they were talking about it, and Joe Scarborough was saying crowd size doesn't matter, and they spent 2 hours talking about crowd size. So it's kind of like, okay, you know what, we're going to move on to something that's a little bit more important. This isn't really, you know, we've talked about it, they're full of crap, you know, big deal. You know, Barack Obama was, you know, a historic figure. So, of course, the crowd size is going to be huge.
You know what I think they should have said after about the crowd size thing? I think the president's spokesman should have come out and said, hey, we understand. We didn't win. We didn't win in Maryland and Virginia. We understand our crowd size here in Washington, D.C. is a little lower. We didn't win in Maryland, Virginia, but we certainly look forward to welcoming all those new voters to our inauguration in 2020. And everybody would have laughed. And they would have all gotten it, and the reporters would have nodded and scribbled in their books, and we could have moved on. That was a completely self-inflicted wound. But the other thing the media is doing that's a self-inflicted wound on their part is they're now starting to run with stories that are completely and easily disprovable as wrong or as alarmist. And as an example, the other night, and I wrote about this in this piece coming out this weekend, Rachel Maddow talking about Voice of America. Oh, my God, President Trump is appointing his own people to the head of Voice of America. Well, of course he is, because Congress passed the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and President Obama signed it, which allows the White House to, you know, which was a bad policy. I mean, I was against this 6 months ago, but suddenly reporting it like, oh, my God, this is unprecedented. Or, oh, my God, the president declared his inauguration day a day of, you know, prayer and patriotism or devotion or whatever he called it. Well, so did Barack Obama. And if you keep doing this where you keep saying this is unprecedented and no one's ever done this and it's a unique crisis, every time that gets disproved, the media is hurting itself. And the only thing saving the media right now is that President Trump seems to be as bad at this game as they are.
Tom, obviously it's frustrating for conservatives and other right-leaning people to see the media freak out and to see the obvious bias that they show towards sensational stories and poorly sourced stories. But at what point does hitting the media for this bias, when do you get to a state of diminishing returns for that? I mean, at what point does your audience say, yeah, the media is biased, we get it, and start to sort of not respond to this argument, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think where it'll start to become a problem for the administration is if things start to go wrong in a way that the average voter palpably feels is wrong, that the economy isn't getting better, that there are foreign policy problems, or that, you know, everybody around them and their dying town is still, you know, hooked on oxy or whatever their beef is, and that's not visibly getting better. Saying that it's all the fault of the lying, failing New York Times is only going to take you so far. That excuse is eventually going to wear thin. I mean, you know, remember that when Nixon came into office, Spiro Agnew hauled off the memorable William Sapphire line about the media just being nattering nabobs of negativism, and everybody kind of, you know, laughed about the way the new administration was sticking it to the media. Well, that was funny, and it was useful right up until Agnew finally had to resign when corruption probes caught up with him, and then finally when the Washington Post helped to bring down Richard Nixon. At some point, you know, you're not, no matter how many times the president says it, the New York Times is not going out of business. And at some point, you know, that you can't just offload the failures of your administration onto the New York Times. Now, if the president succeeds and a lot of these policies do well, then that's actually going to be a very tricky situation for the media, because a lot of them are not going to want to report that. I mean, if the, you know, if unemployment stays low, or if you know, jobs grow, or whatever it is that the president's promised to do, if that starts to happen and the media really does get out there and say, well, this isn't really true, then I think that they're going to hurt their credibility more.
Let's assume that the administration's not going to wise up anytime soon. And for those people who are invested in the advancement of the conservative project, or who want to see Republican legislative victories, what should they be focused on with this administration? You know, should they be in lockstep with them, hammering the media and running interference, or should they attempt to perhaps glean legitimate criticisms from things like the millions of people who took to the streets to march for the Women's March, or just from the relentless negativity from all corners of the media? Is there anything valuable there? And should conservative media attempt to make that case, even if the administration doesn't seem receptive to it?
Well, I'm going to bring up three people who normally are not usually agreeing with each other. And that is David Frum, David Harsanyi, and Bill Maher. And I think all three of them have given us something to watch for as conservatives. David Harsanyi had a great piece today in The Federalist, today being early in the week and the last day of January here. And David's point was conservatives have to kind of pick and choose and see what they can get from an administration that is kind of a grab bag of ideas. I mean, the president himself is not ideologically consistent. He wasn't known as, you know, a conservative for a lot of years. He's kind of a big city machine guy. But there will be wins. I mean, we were talking about the Supreme Court nomination, right? I think conservatives can say, well, whatever else is wrong with the Trump administration, we got Neil Gorsuch out of it, so that's fine. And, you know, now we go on to the next thing. And you kind of duke it out issue by issue by issue, seeing where the legislature goes and what's possible. My guess is that that's kind of the Ryan McConnell approach at this point. I think David Frum had a very dark, alarmist piece in The Atlantic today.
Tell me more.
Where he said, look, you know, there are possible, this is what to look for if the United States begins to decay into an illiberal democracy or even an authoritarian system. And I think he laid out some really important markers about where the courts go and ruling by executive order and the kind of exhaustion of the opposition, finally just kind of caving to things they know they shouldn't give into. And I think that's, so on the one hand, as a day-to-day issue, I think conservatives have to say, well, let's, you know, let that President Trump's a box of chocolates, right? You never know what you're going to get, but you have to hope to get the things you like out of it. Frum had a really good piece about the long-term trends to look for, that, you know, the big direction of the arrow, is it going toward more freedom or less? Marr had a great line the other night where he said, look, the only future of the country, sane Republicans are the only future of the country. And I think that there's something to that. Because frankly, you know, we're not gonna, it's pretty difficult to reason with people that are marching in the street and, you know, banging the Hitler drum, which I think is just a stupid thing to do. Only Hitler was Hitler. I get it in my Twitter feed all the time. I say, look, don't panic. It's okay to be concerned, but panic and hysteria. And people, somebody actually said to me the other day, well, how big does the genocide have to get before you're concerned?
Well, oh my God.
You know, you're not going to reason with those people. That's not even a conversation worth having.
Right.
So I think this notion of sane Republicans being kind of the barometer between, I think that, you know, the concerns of somebody like Frum and the, what can, you know, the kind of more transactional approach of people like David Harsanyi, that's a good way to look at it. So I think, you know, concerned, vigilant, make sure that the civil liberties lines aren't crossed, hope that you can get the most conservative policies you can get. My lowest bar for all this is, as long as there is no major military conflict in the next 4 years, we can probably survive a lot of other things. I'm a foreign policy guy. Maybe that's why it's what I obsess about.
Yeah,
but that's my big concern.
Well, now define major military conflict, because one of Trump's executive orders was to for the chiefs of staff to come up with a plan to fight ISIS within 30 days. Would that be a major conflict?
Not to me, it isn't, and I don't mean you know, that doesn't mean that if somebody gets killed doing it, it wasn't a, you know, major tragedy. It's one of my friends, had a friend who served in Vietnam, and he said, you know, they called it a low intensity conflict, but it seemed pretty intense while I was there.
Yeah.
So I mean something that could raise an existential or major or existential threat to the United States itself. And I know it's fashionable to say that ISIS is an existential threat, but I think we have to stop talking that way. When I talk about a major conflict, I mean a major U.S.-Chinese naval clash, something that involves Russia and NATO over an Article 5 issue in Europe, something on that order. I don't mean skirmishing and attacking and bombing and fighting on the ground, even with ISIS, who I think, I won't call them the JV. I think President Obama was, you know, that was one of the worst mistakes of his presidency, was to try and minimize that. But these guys are not, they're not the Chinese army either. And so I think that is going to be a kind of daily, we're going to be dealing with people like ISIS daily, but I'm talking about a major conflict that mobilizes our armed forces in a large way against a peer competitor like Russia or China. And as long as we can avoid that kind of problem, I think most of the other things can probably be handled by competent people, he said, hopefully.
And the other thing, just to kind of take a step back to the whole media relationship with Trump, and I'm going to say this again, this goes out to the Trump faithful, stop portraying every screw up that they have, or sometimes when the media falls over themselves, as Trump trolling the media, like this is some part of some big plan or scheme or something like that.
Right, everything's a plan. I think it was Dave Weigel today who said, boy, I wish every time I screwed up, people attributed it to a master brainiac secret plan.
Yeah. I mean, and I've told people, I said, it's possible for the Trump administration, for Trump and his people to be ridiculous at times and for the media to be stupid at the same time.
It can
exist. You know, those two can coexist. It doesn't have to be one or the other. So
Go
ahead.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing the Trump loyalists need to stop doing, stop playing the victim. You guys won.
Yes.
You're not victims. You won. You have united Republican government. You have the House, you have the Senate, and you have the White House. Stop whining about how, you know, put upon you are and how mean the media are. You know, I feel like I'm about to go all Vito Corleone and slap them in the face and say, you know, you can act like a man. but, you know, enough of this, of, oh, we're the underdogs. You're not the underdogs anymore. You're the establishment. You're it. You know, wanted this. You're the dog. You're the dog chasing this bus, but you caught it now.
That's it.
Stop acting like you're somehow, you know, this put upon minority. And I think that's, you know, that's really it's not only unseemly, but it's self-defeating.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, you know, the final subject here, let's talk about the immigration executive order, the one that it was a temporary, not a full-time ban, temporary ban, or so to speak, from travel from 7 different countries, a 120-day kind of moratorium on refugees from all countries, and an indefinite suspension of Syrian refugees coming into the country. So the first thing that I noticed about this, and this is where you talk about the DEFCON 1, is that, you know, everybody started calling this a Muslim ban, that this was a Muslim ban. And I don't, and you know, if you look at the language of the executive order, I'm not even an attorney, and there's nothing in there about religion. It wasn't based on that. That said, the way they rolled this out was just, it was complete amateur hour, and how they conducted it, and how, you know, the idea that congressional staff helped formulate this without the knowledge of the people that they work for and had to sign non-disclosure agreements. I mean,
I've been wondering about that. I mean, I'm a former Hill guy, and I, you know, now I get it. You know, Hill staff routinely work with the White House, and you don't have to run in and tell your boss every day, hey, I got a call from the White House. But I mean, if you're working on something that is incredibly explosive like this, and you're being asked to sign an NDA, and you don't tell your boss, I mean, I'd have been drawn and quartered for doing that to my boss. So I'm having a hard time believing this notion that people on the Hill didn't know, or I don't know. There's something that just doesn't sound right about this whole business to me. So, and I wonder if there's a plausible deniability issue that, you know, got that once the White House kind of ratted everybody out and said, well, the Hill staffers wrote it, and all the guys on the Hill went, oh, well, it wasn't my staffer didn't tell me, you know, they're just crazy kids that got the car keys and who knows where they are at night. So I'm having trouble with that whole story. But the thing you mentioned about the Muslim ban, I've been trying to get people to understand, if you keep saying it's a Muslim ban, if you're really that opposed to the president, then stop helping him. Because what the White House wanted to get across to the heartland voters is, this is a Muslim ban. Rudy Giuliani said it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's not a Muslim ban, but if you people in the media want to keep saying it's a Muslim ban, well, okay, then I guess I kept a campaign promise that I made, you know, somewhere in Ohio or Pennsylvania. And it's a win for me, even though it doesn't actually do any of that. And it strikes me just crazy.
And, you know, and that's not to say that, you know, people in the heartland necessarily think that all Muslims are terrorists, but they do think that many terrorists are Muslim. And so they draw that natural correlation. And I think, you know, speaking to people in the language that they in the shorthand, you know, is kind of useful.
Saying, I did something I promised to do, even if you thought it was a good night, even if you think it wasn't the greatest idea I ever had, I did say I would do it, and here I am, I'm doing it. The problem is, if you really were a dedicated kind of more thoughtful media analyst here, if you really wanted to make a point about this, you'd say, well, this executive order, you know, you people, speaking to those people out in the heartland, right? So you people, you think that's what he's doing, but this thing doesn't actually do it. And it was, you know, it's a jalopy. It's this Rube Goldberg kind of thing that was put out there, and it's all going to fall apart in court. Instead, they're basically adopting the president's narrative, saying, yep, it's a Muslim ban. He did what he said he was going
to
do.
Well, and the other thing is, yeah, if they want to actually chip away at Trump's base of support, you're absolutely right. They need to hit him on incompetence and not being able to deliver on his promises. They absolutely don't need to frame this in terms of religious persecution or racism, because who's that going to convince? The people who are already out there in the street.
And also, who's it going to offend? That the people who voted for Trump are already immune to that issue. If you say, look, this is one of the first things I ever wrote about the Trump candidacy was over a year ago. And I said, look, if you keep hammering these political correctness points, you're just prepping the ground for somebody like Trump, because the American people have heard that so many times now that they're just deaf to it and say, well, you know, that's racist. And they say, yeah, well, everything's racist. Okay. Whereas, you know, one of the things that struck me in all this, for example, is this is a major foreign policy move. And yet I didn't see one reporter walking up to Rex Tillerson saying, Mr. Secretary Designate, what do you think about this? Because there wasn't any time to do that, because everybody was so busy going on about racism and the Muslim ban and that preferred narrative, as opposed to saying, wait, who actually wrote this? Who vetted this? Did, you know, what does the Secretary Designate think about it? Which are all much more professionalized questions and much more kind of inside Washington questions, but also, I think, much more trenchant questions. And instead, you know, the administration, I said this the other day, the administration puts a cage of rabbits out there and all the greyhounds just chase them until they're exhausted.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's, you know,
depressing.
Yeah, that, it's... I got to say, this is going to be, you know, and I say this as somebody who's a political writer, and Tom is probably the same thing. We are going to have a lot of material to write about over the next 4 months. Forget about 4 years. We're going to have our baskets full for the next few months. It's going to be something else. So
you guys have fun with that.
Yeah.
I kind of hope I don't. I mean, my beat is foreign policy, and since my thing is foreign policy, I really don't want to have a lot to write about over the next 4 months, because if I'm writing something, it's probably bad. What was your last book on? Well, nuclear weapons. Oh, so you must be interested. No, please. You know, I'd much rather be. But I think also, you know, unlike the campaign, where we're making arguments about hypotheticals and we're advocating back and forth, who do we want to see govern the country? What kind of ideas do we want to see? But the fact of the matter is, Donald Trump won the election. And I think we have to go out of that partisan mode and out of that election mode. And I think we have to put on our policy analyst hats and say, for whether you like the outcome of the election or not, now we have to be very serious about examining policy. And I think people aren't making that transition very well. The voters certainly aren't, the media aren't. And I think the few people out there at places like think tanks or other places that study policy, they're getting drowned out, because the other thing that's happening in all this is I still think there's a hard knot of people, like the people that are out there in the street, a lot of the folks that are out there protesting the street, who still believe that somewhere there's still a silver bullet that's going to end the Trump presidency tomorrow.
Yeah, and I don't buy that.
Go for that.
Yeah, but at the same time,
they're wrong, obviously. Or, you know, but I mean, there's always a silver bullet that could end any presidency, I suppose.
Right.
You know.
Once again, these opinions do not reflect those of Naval.
Yeah, because now all of a sudden you're talking silver bullet, and they're going to be like, Tom Nichols was on a podcast and was threatening to shoot the president. You know.
Well, yeah. To quote our favorite movie, Caddyshack. Oh, that's all I need. but my point is, the people who are out there thinking there's some silver bullet to, you know, that's counterproductive. That means you're always looking for some magical solution to your problems. And I think people have to stop doing that. They have to sit down and say, okay, look, this man is the president. He's going to issue policies. We have to think about those in a sober, judicious way. And I think that that's one of the reasons that I've been having a lot of arguments on social media with people who have been taken to the streets, because I said, look, you're not going to end the Trump presidency in a day. It doesn't work that way. And I think it's irresponsible, and I will even venture to say unpatriotic to do that. You know, one of the last things Hillary Clinton said in her public life is that we owe Donald Trump a chance to govern. And again, whether you like his policies or not, he's the president for the next 4 years. We have to look at those policies as policy analysts rather than as just playing this game of partisan hockey. And I think if people can't make that transition, we're going to have a lot of really pointless arguments over the next 4 years.
That makes sense to me. And I think it's a good place to wrap it up. We've been talking to Tom Nichols, that's at Radio Free Tom on Twitter, who is, among other things, the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Tom, when's that book coming out?
In about 4 hours.
4 hours, baby. Yes. Come on.
Whoa, get out to Amazon.
We're going to put an Amazon link in there for you.
By the time your listeners hear this, it'll be live on Kindle and shipping from Amazon and Barnes & Noble everywhere. So,
congratulations.
As you know, the book is already out. Yes.
Congratulations, sir. That's a good achievement. And it's a fantastic subject. Great book. Looking forward to reading it myself. So, anyway, Tom, we do have one more piece of business to conclude before we let you go to get back to your book release party.
We do. And, okay. You want to do it, Neil?
I'll go ahead and ask you this time, Jay. You know, Tom, you were with us last time, so you know we do a gotcha question at the very end. What you may not know is that we switch it up. We switch it up, you know, especially if we've had someone on before. And so the gotcha question that we've settled on for this round is very important, cultural question. It will affect our culture for years to come. And that question is this: do you think Tom Hardy would make a good James Bond?
Oh dear God, what is wrong with you people? Tom Hardy? No way. No.
Thank you, Tom.
That is insane. First of all, you can't be my name is Bond, James Bond. I mean, the guy talks like he has a mouthful of gravel. I think Tom Hardy is one of the great actors. If you've seen a movie called Legend, where he plays two roles at the same time, it's one of the real feats of acting. But Tom Hardy with that kind of mush mouth voice and broken nose looks, no way. So let's just settle this right now. Tom Hardy will never be James Bond.
See, this may be the first one of these questions that goes my way from the jump.
Well, you didn't. I'm not going to say anything.
Advocating for Tom Hardy as James Bond.
He is, to his shame.
No, to being right. You know, it's a good opinion. You know, it's like, and I say, if you watch Inception, he plays a, you know, that is kind of the role that he plays in that movie, and that's why he would be good at it.
No, first of all, it's a completely wrong opinion. And I mean, Tom Hardy as James Bond why is Leo DiCaprio booked? I mean, you couldn't think. There's simply no way that Tom Hardy is James Bond. I could, even Tom Hiddleston, I was having problems with. And let's not get into the whole Idris Elba debate because no one's going to come out of that looking good. But no, Tom Hardy, it's not happening. Jay's wrong. Neil's right. I'm glad that as an expert with a book about experts, I was able to settle this issue for you guys.
It feels real good. Jay, I'm sorry, man.
Well,
sorry.
when the first movie comes out with Tom Hardy as James Bond and it makes a gazillion dollars, then we'll revisit this episode.
Jay, if Tom Hardy becomes James Bond, I will fly to wherever the premiere is and take you.
Okay. Now we got that on record, everyone. So if the premiere is in London, Tom is flying us out to London.
Right. Well, if it opens in Leicester Square, then, you know, I'm probably screwed for saying that, but I'm so confident. the other thing is I would have been really confident that nobody would have picked Daniel Craig as James Blonde either. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't have put that one on tape. Maybe we can edit that part out after the show.
My money is on Channing Tatum, honestly.
Oh God!
Well, I thought Tom Hiddleston was in the lead after.
Yeah, and there's somebody who doesn't fit the role at all. So I mean, that's even worse than Tom Hardy.
I was joking.
Huh? I don't know about that. I mean, if I had to pick between Hiddleston and Hardy, I'd pick Tom Hiddleston.
Hiddleston's a dork.
I think the upper edge of bad decisions now. And it'll probably be somebody neither one of us expected, but I just can't imagine it's going to be Tom Hart.
Well, we'll see.
Unless he plays it with that Kentucky drawl from that hillbilly movie he did. That would be awesome.
See, that just shows the range that he has as an actor. So, all right. Well, Tom Nichols, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate you
Thanks
coming
for having
on.
Me as always, guys.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, once you're, you know, we'll have you on again at some point, you know, now when your book is out, so we can actually talk about, you know, some of the stuff that we're reading. That'll be kind of fun. And it's going on sale in a few hours. Well, if you hear this, you will hear this before it goes on sale. So you can actually go to Amazon and wait and for the countdown, and it's gonna happen. So all right, and so for Neil Dewing, I'm Jay Caruso, and we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.